From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. What do you need to feel like yourself?
What would I do without you? No, you. You complete me.
This hour, we'll talk about Paste Magazine's return to print. But first, the president's mental state has been much in the news again this week. A tell-all book by a former advisor inspired President Trump to tweet again. And he proclaimed himself a, quote, stable genius, end quote. Last year, we talked about the science behind narcissism with University of Georgia psychology professor Keith Campbell. He says social media and narcissism go hand in hand.
And it also predicts using social media for narcissistic ends, to self-promote, to get attention, to display your positive qualities. So if you think about it, social media is a great ground for people who are narcissistic to get their needs, their narcissistic or ego needs met.
We heard from some of you about our look at narcissism. Here are your first thoughts. Sybil lives in Macon, and she emails us. Her ex-husband exhibited narcissistic qualities. She says she believes Professor Campbell, quote, watered down somewhat the topic by speaking so much about the non-medical narcissism of the general population who are on social media. End quote. We always love to get your thoughts, narcissistic or not. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. We've all seen it. Somebody shops on their work computer, or they take really long lunches, or borrow supplies. The workplace doesn't always foster the most ethical behavior. But recent University of Georgia research shows it can be worse than that. Many employees lie in their timesheets and even trash their coworkers to get ahead. I talked about this with Marie Mitchell, a professor of management in the Terry College of Business at UGA, and Karen Rommelfanger, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Emory University. So, Marie, let's talk about sort of the limitations of the study, right? What questions was it intended to answer?
Well, my colleagues and I were very interested in understanding what workplace cheating behavior would be. There's been quite a few studies about cheating, but primarily those studies occur in labs and experiments. And they're very informative, but what we wanted to know is, what are employees seeing? What are they actually doing in organizations? And so we conducted a study that asked employees across the nation about, just give us various examples of behaviors you have actually seen at work. And over 500 individuals gave us examples, and we kind of culled those down into various categories of cheating behavior. More than 50% of those examples were cheating, where the individual is engaging in unethical behavior, self-interested behavior that alters their own work behavior, such as falsifying timesheets. And 30% were behaviors where individuals were cheating by undermining their coworkers for self-gain. The rest of them didn't really fall into what we believed were a category of cheating behavior, although they were definitely bad work behaviors. They're called deviant behaviors, where individuals are basically surfing the web. And in that respect, while it's bad, it's not cheating behavior because it wasn't really entered into for a purpose of self-gain. At least we didn't think so. So from that point, we decided to really unpack what's the reasons why employees are engaging in these behaviors.
And to interrupt you for just a second, any of our listeners can call in with things that you've seen as well. Some of them don't entirely qualify. Jane Moore tweets this: hands down for me, the worst thing she's seen was a coworker in a tiny two-person office who flossed her teeth at her desk. That's gross, Jane, but I don't think that's unethical.
No.
So, Karen, when we're talking about why people do this, is there a difference in the way we view behavior at the workplace as opposed to the way we view behavior just in our regular lives?
Well, I think in this context, well, first, by definition, cheating means you're breaking the rules.
Right.
Right? So the rules in various contexts are different. So in this case, I think there's a discussion of, or there's an assumption, and they're defined in the study as what is considered cheating. And it's a violation of what is, I think in the paper states, of global norms. And also, I think that I've seen Dr. Mitchell also speak about a violation of rules, legal rules.
Oh, right.
I actually disagree with the first one, because I think breaking a rule or something that is legally deemed doesn't necessarily have to be unethical. For example, slavery was legal for a while, so I don't think that's sufficient.
Meaning that in your mind, the law is not always the best arbiter of ethics.
No.
Well, then let's go back to the study, Marie. And we also have things like, I think would qualify. Deanna Garcia tweets, when I worked at Starbucks, a shift manager would routinely take whole gallons of milk, mugs, glasses, and parts of gift sets. It was often just two of us. So to cover my butt, I snitched. And in this particular case, not only, it sounds like she's describing someone who's literally stealing, right? Which is unethical. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like she's saying that she's told on this employee because she was trying to save herself also, which kind of fits into some of the motivations you discovered.
Well, I believe she's probably worried that her employer is going to blame her for the behavior. So in that respect, I wouldn't consider what she was doing as unethical, but it's definitely self-protective. In the study, what we find is that the reason why employees cheat is because of performance pressure. The idea that employees believe that they have to raise their performance efforts because they're linked to significant consequences, such as losing their job. And that creates and elicits self-protective emotions, such as anger and cognitions, which give them a really strong focus. So that whole need for self-protection is pretty innate to humans. And so it's not surprising that that particular employee wanted to protect herself also. But for different reasons than we found in our study for cheating behavior.
And there have been some pretty headline-grabbing cheating examples here in Georgia. We had the Atlanta Public Schools. Another international example is the Volkswagen scandal of 2015. Here's author Jack Ewing explaining to CBS why Volkswagen ended up doing what they did.
They were desperate to get back market share in the United States, and the way they thought they would do that was by selling diesels as an environmentally friendly technology. Yeah. But the engineers realized that they couldn't make the cars compliant with the U.S. rules, and so they came up with this cheat. I think they probably meant it as a short-term stopgap, but then it became a habit.
And Karen, this is interesting to me because Marie's talking about self-protective behavior. And to what extent do we justify unethical behavior so that we can accept it as not being unethical? Do you understand what I'm saying? Something which would maybe objectively be unethical, changing the technology on a car. But we, because we have fears of losing our jobs or pressures, we justify that. Is that pretty common?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think self-justification and rationalizing is often how we engage in unethical behavior. I mean, there are really two main contributors to unethical behavior. And one is cognitive load. So stress, like performance pressure, can be one of them. And this is supported by neuroscience and psychological literature. And another is environment. And so I think an important point here is that the unethical behavior we see is more a canary in the coal mine situation. It's a description, it's really indicating a systemic problem of organizations that value products more than people and productivity more than the people they employ. And I think in these cases, you reap what you sow. I mean, this is the environment that is cultivating the cheating behavior.
And that's actually echoed by this comment from Mel Fugate, professor of business at Southern Methodist University. This sounds like exactly what he's talking about.
It affects performance in many ways. So if it affects your performance as an individual employee, that obviously affects the performance of your coworkers, your boss, your unit, your larger organization. And again, if the incidence is so high, this is happening in many places every day.
And Marie, that's an interesting question, is to what extent workplace culture contributes to either supporting or discouraging unethical behavior. How does a workplace create a culture that doesn't encourage that?
Yeah, Mel's absolutely right. There's quite a bit of research that has demonstrated the importance of climate and culture and organizational infrastructures. And what's unfortunate is that when organizations, managers within them, and employees succumb to these types of pressures to continuously compete, sustain profitability, they often turn a blind eye on how those things get done. And it gets normalized within organizations that employees who are new sometimes often don't know or unaware of the steps that have been taken out that are appropriate to maintain their behavior in an ethical manner. And so it does very much happen to where organizations get caught up and the individuals within them perpetuate the unethical behavior, and it's a vicious cycle.
And it's difficult, Karen, I would imagine, to create a balance between trying to motivate people by healthy competition as opposed to taking that too far to where it encourages unethical behavior. Are there ways that a manager or a CEO can do that, can maintain that balance?
Mm-hmm. I think there's modeling. You know, there's a modeling of demonstrating the broader values of creating a good within an organization. There's a showing that you value the individuals that you work with. I think in these cases where we see cheating, like that are discussed in the paper, these are situations where people are trying to regain some sense of autonomy, regain some sense of control, that they're valued. And I would even say that in some ways it's more rewarding than participating as kind of more of a robot or in service of an employer.
And Marie, did you end up being surprised by the results of this research?
No. They're pretty much supported by theory. I have done follow-up work on performance pressure, investigating it across time, day to day, at multiple times a day. Because let's face it, I don't cheat. I am under pressure. There's a lot of individuals who are under pressure and they don't cheat. And so it was really important for me and my colleagues to kind of unpack what really triggers one employee to cheat and to engage in bad behavior where another doesn't. And as Karen noted, there are stressors that happen. And so day to day, employees handle stress differently. And the critical thing that we're finding for managers to focus on is diffusing the threat associated with performance pressure. Because what research has also found, as you alluded to, is if you don't give any kind of little nudge or pressure to employees, their productivity can stagnate too. So it leaves employees in a really prickly position and managers. How do you pressure without eliciting bad behavior? And so the critical thing that we have found is to get employees to see it as challenging, to provide them the right infrastructures to where they can learn in an appropriate manner, be challenged
without it being encouraged to engage in unethical behavior.
Exactly.
That's Marie Mitchell, professor of management in the Terry College of Business at UGA, and Karen Rommelfanger is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, one magazine returns to print while others fold. But first, do rich kids always finish first? There's a disturbing trend in university admissions. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you're rich, you have a much better chance of getting into college. The Equality of Opportunity Project found top Ivy League schools admit more students from the top 1% of earners than the bottom 60% combined. But those schools get higher marks in the all-important U.S. News rankings of best colleges. So is that ranking system making the inequality gap worse? I spoke to Tim Renick, Vice President for Student Success Programs at Georgia State University. GSU is a national model for graduating low-income students, though it slid 30 spots in the U.S. News rankings. And I spoke with Mitchell Stevens, a professor of sociology at Stanford University. So I want to start with you, Mitchell, because I want to take on this theory people have that the rankings are actually encouraging colleges to accept kids who come from wealthier families. Do you buy that theory?
Well, the rankings reward colleges and universities for being more rather than less selective, for admitting fewer students rather than more students. And they reward schools for admitting students who have high grade point averages and standardized test scores. And we know that high standardized test scores especially parallel closely students' social class backgrounds. So to the extent that schools are encouraged to court a certain kind of young man or woman and their families, they do abet a certain kind of competition for wealthy high achievers.
Although you could make the argument that maybe it's the standardized tests that are part of the problem, right? Instead of the rankings?
Yeah, but I guess you could, that would be sort of, you know, pulling apart Siamese twins in a way.
I see.
There's a whole bundle of competitive systems in the United States that are really hard to pull apart. And to the extent that we're expecting public flagship universities to increasingly compete with each other nationwide, you know, rather than specifically serving the residents of their state, we're just encouraging this process.
So, Tim, did Georgia State, did you guys know it was going to hurt your rankings for you to pursue this goal of graduating more low-income students, of graduating more first-time college attendees? Did you know that might hurt you?
We were aware of the implications, yeah. One thing we did as we launched this program is looked at the correlation for our students between SAT scores and their chances of graduating, and we found almost no correlation. What was a much better indicator of student success were a lot of other factors, like what courses they took in high school and what their grades were. Those type of considerations don't tend to fall into the rankings and get weighed very heavily because they're hard to quantify. So SAT score is used a lot, but SAT scores doesn't really predict whether students will succeed at places like Georgia State. So we made a conscious effort. We said we're going to control for the factors that mean the most for our student success, not for SAT scores. And as a result, we've dropped over 20 points in SAT scores. At the same time, we've improved our graduation rates by 22 percentage points.
Yeah, it's incredible how many kids you're actually getting across that graduation stage. Let's hear this comment from Lynn O'Shaughnessy. She's with the University of California, San Diego, and she says the U.S. News rankings are actually bogus. That's basically her point.
It's not a scientific methodology. In fact, the major factor is what all the schools think of each other. So all schools in a particular category, like National University category, they all rank each other on a 1-5 scale every year. So, of course, it's absurd. What does somebody at San Diego State know about what's going on at University of Connecticut or University of Missouri, where I went to school? It's a flawed way of evaluating schools.
What do you think of that, Mitchell? Is she correct that it's not scientific?
There's most academics and measurement experts agree with that the ranking systems themselves are not the best scientific indicators of quality, but that certainly hasn't prevented them from reorganizing the market for higher education. The bottom line is twofold. One is uncertainty, and the other is money. Families really don't know very much about higher education, and colleges and universities, frankly, don't make it terribly easy for families to understand relative quality. And so the rankings, you know, fill in that gap of knowledge for families. The money part is that our public universities are increasingly seeking wealthy out-of-state families who pay high tuition rates to subsidize their bottom lines. We have nationwide, defunded public higher education, and it's an expensive proposition. So there's a very strong incentive for public universities across the country to court families who can pay high tuition rates.
So, Tim, at Georgia State, it appears to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, of course, that you have sort of redefined what success means for the university. There's the U.S. News rankings. You kind of have tossed that out in terms of defining whether you're succeeding in your mission. Is that accurate?
I think that is accurate. That, you know, what role should a public university in the middle of downtown Atlanta serve for the community? It should be able to support the students who need us, not go out of the state and try to find students with the best SAT scores and the strongest socioeconomic background. But the rankings force institutions to just that move if they want to move up in the rankings. Selectivity. If you reject more students, you rank higher in the rankings. If you spend more dollars per every student, you rank higher in the rankings. Many of the most important rankings don't take any consideration of the cost for per the student. What is the net cost of the education? And as a result, you can, as a consumer, be greatly misled by saying, I'm going to a high-ranked institution. It may not be the institution that serves you well.
And part of that, Tim, is because of how universities are rewarded, right? I mean, if you're Harvard, you're rewarded over and over and over in reputation, in the amount of charitable dollars that you get. Is a school like yours, which has a completely different mission, do you feel as though in the broader educational marketplace you get the same sort of rewards?
Well, what's encouraging is that the reward system is shifting. Not the rankings are shifting. They've remained pretty constant. But there are voices out there now that recognize that if you are an institution that's graduating more low-income students, and Georgia State's now graduating more black students than any other college or university in the United States, our low-income students are graduating at the same rate as our middle and upper-income students.
I wonder if people realize how surprising that is.
And how very rare that is as well. There are just a couple schools nationally that can claim that. And so, you know, we've had our own recognitions. Bill Gates was just visiting campus a few weeks ago. He was here for a keynote at the World Congress Center and invited himself to come and learn more about our programs. We've been invited to the White House. President Obama was a big fan of the kind of work we're doing and cited us and so forth. So it's nice to get those sorts of recognitions, but it makes even starker the contrast with an institution that is being recognized by the Gates Foundation and by the President of the United States at the same time it's moving down in the elite rankings, yes.
Let me play you this comment, Mitchell, from Carolyn Hawksby. She's in at Stanford with you. Studies this issue of income diversity, and she says a number of high achievers but low-income students don't apply to big schools.
That doesn't mean that they're rural, but that they're one of the only two or three very high-achieving students in their high school. But the high school counselor doesn't have the time or the expertise to be able to help the students sort out the full range of colleges in the United States and know about all the financial aid opportunities that are out there.
So what is the solution here, Mitchell? And in addition, we've heard what Georgia State is doing. Are there things that we're not doing?
So I'm really glad you raised this work by Carolyn. I think that raises an additional contradictory dynamic in the sector in which many social scientists like Professor Hawksby are explicitly advocating that elite schools like Stanford and Harvard go out and scour the country to find those two or three highest achievers and recruit them to elite schools. There's another argument to be made. You know, why shouldn't those top students be going to places like Georgia State or excellent universities that are close to home? I'd say American academics at the moment, we can't decide whether we should cream the top students and send them all to Harvard, or whether we should do more to support the comprehensive universities like Georgia State that are closer to these young people and their families.
Tim, we only have a minute left, but I'm assuming that you would say send them to Georgia State.
We'd love to have them, and we think they have a great chance of succeeding. But I'll add one comment that it's not just lack of knowledge, although that's important, that some of these students don't realize that there are Stanfords and Harvards out there that are willing to give them scholarships and pave the way for them to attend. We find with a lot of our low-income students, they're connected to their families in a very real and financial way. They're contributing, for instance, to the rent and the food costs for the household. And so staying close to home means the family prospering as well.
That is Tim Renick, Vice President for Student Success Programs at Georgia State. And you also heard Mitchell Stevens, Professor of Sociology at Stanford University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
A pleasure being here.
In recent years, many newspapers and magazines have abandoned their print publications for an all-digital format, from the Christian Science Monitor to Newsweek to Jet Magazine, and then most recently, Atlanta's Creative Loafing shrunk from a print weekly to a monthly. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning. But today, the exception. One Decatur-based magazine actually moved from digital back to print. Paste Magazine is less than a year into publishing its new quarterly, and I talked about the revival of print with magazine co-founder and editor-in-chief, Josh Jackson. Why? Why going back to print? Everyone keeps saying print is dead.
Yeah, so for us, we had struggled. We put out a print magazine for 8 years, from 2002 to 2010. And during those last few years, it was a struggle. I mean, the problems of print magazines were very evident to us, from the distribution model to the reliance on advertising. And when advertising went away, that really hurt us, and we had to leave print. The reason to go back into print is not, for us, we are still primarily a digital company. Our website is growing. We've added lots of different topics that we're covering, so we've gone broader and deeper on our website. But for us, it just felt like the time to re-engage our core audience with something special. We wanted to create something that wasn't, going to be on every newsstand and in your checkout counter line and just sort of a quick grab, but something that was going to show up in your mailbox once a quarter, and you're going to be really glad to get it because, we've put a lot of care into this product. It's 12 by 12. It comes with a vinyl record. It's not your typical magazine.
How much of the print decision is influenced by the kind of magazine that you are, the kind of uniqueness you were just talking about, mm-hmm. as opposed to, say, Newsweek maybe not being so successful going back to print?
Yeah, and for us, this is a quarterly magazine, so we're not trying to deliver you the latest news with this magazine. These are about longer reads, about things that you can kind of stop and take the time to savor. And we do have a website where you can get the latest news about music or movies or television or politics. And that's not the kind of thing that was really going to fit with a print magazine. But for us, because we are this arts and culture and entity, there are so many stories that we felt would be better to tell in a more visual form of print, and that we could really curate an experience for you with the print magazine.
Is it a profit-making venture, though? Do you expect to make a profit off it, or is it a love of the magazine?
Well, I don't think we're going to make a ton of money off it, but yeah, I do think it'll be profitable for the company. We've set this up in such a way where we are not reliant on our advertisers. We're asking our subscribers to cover the paper and mailing costs of the product, which is unusual in the magazine world. When you get a magazine in the mail, it probably costs way more to print and mail that product to you than you spend on it. It's all about the advertising. It's all about a way to get those ads in front of you. And for us, I mean, there is advertising in the magazine, but it's a small amount. It's mostly craft beer and music labels, because those are companies that we've had long-term relationships with and just wanted to sort of be part of this and support this. And but it's not, we're not going after the car companies and the mass brands to sort of foot the bill for this kind of thing.
But it's also something that somebody would leave on their coffee table, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we're hoping for, is that this is, we've tried to make kind of a work of art here.
So what is different between the things? How do you choose what is digital and then what ends up going onto an actual page?
Yeah, so for us, there needs to be a timelessness aspect of it, because, there's a lag in when you put this thing together and when it's delivered to your audience. So we wanted the kinds of stories that you didn't necessarily know you wanted to read, but you're going to be glad you did. So much of what happens online is people come to our website, and it's way more people than we ever had with our print magazine. We had over 8 million unique visitors to our site last month. But a lot of those people had one thing in particular they wanted to come and visit to read. They'd come and they'd read it and then they'd leave, read a couple things and then leave. And for us, we wanted to tell those stories that nobody's doing a Google search for.
That's Josh Jackson. He's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Paste Magazine. Last year, the magazine returned to print format after being all digital for 7 years. Coming up, a new novel shares stories we did not know about the Civil War. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last summer's chaos in Charlottesville raised a number of questions about Southern identity. An important one is, how do we look at and contextualize Confederate symbols? In Georgia, we have many monuments that honor Confederate soldiers. Decatur, Athens, Rome, and dozens more cities are home to statues and memorials and markers. There have been a number of calls to move or demolish those markers. Here's President Trump's feelings on those efforts.
Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now are we going to take down his statue?
We also talked about this with Valerie Babb, director of the Institute for African American Studies at UGA. She says it might be worth it to keep them up so we can understand them better.
What I think we're talking about is rethinking what those memorials represent, because they're not really about the past. They're more about our attitudes towards race and justice today. So I think people who are calling for taking them down probably are really calling for a reevaluation of where we stand towards our history and towards what those monuments represent.
And we've been asking you about this. We visited the Confederate statue in downtown Macon. Here's what Maconite Calvin Watkins had to say about that memorial.
Since I've been in Macon all my life, and it been sitting there, and I'm 74 years old, well, for my part, really, I think it need to come down.
We also spoke to another Macon resident, Lori Scott. She has a different opinion.
You can't change history, so what's the point of taking down the monuments? That's what history is. You see what happened in the past, so you prevent it from happening in the future.
And now it's your turn. We are collecting your opinions, your perspectives on Confederate monuments in Georgia. Later this month, we'll dedicate a full hour to discussing what those memorials mean to our state and what we should do about them. We need your input, so call us at 404-500-9457. Leave us a message telling us about a Confederate monument that's near you and what you think should be done about it. You can also post to our Facebook page, of course, or tweet us. We're at OST Talk. And you can also email us. There's any number of ways to reach us. Our email address is onsecondthought@gpb.org. Author Darren Wong's new novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires, offers a fresh take on the American Civil War. Darren will be at the Savannah Book Festival next month. I spoke to him in September. So almost as interesting as the actual story in the novel is the story of how this novel came to be. Now, did you know about this history before you found out you were living in that house?
No. So we moved into this house when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, the whole bizarre history didn't even, you know, as a five-year-old, it doesn't really intrude into your mindset. And, you know, parts of it kind of were presented to us, but it didn't fit together. And, you know, some of it was wives' tales and crazy and stuff like that. So kind of discovering what was true and what was not was a lot of the fun.
So you ended up in this town that you write about is Town Line, New York.
Yeah.
And the interesting tidbit about it is that it was the only town. It's just outside Buffalo, right?
Yes.
It's the only town north of the Mason-Dixon line that seceded.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, did not rejoin the Union until like the 1940s?
1946, January 1946, to be precise.
So you pitched this for years to authors to, to have them write it as a book.
Yeah, I mean, because somebody ought to, right?
So give me an example of how you pitched them.
Well, if you're out drinking with authors or something like
which
that,
I'm sure you know, you've done
as
often.
I would often do because with the festival, and you know, these stories would come up, you know, and particularly down here in the South, a bizarre Southern, you know, the granddad or great great granddad buried the silver in the backyard kind of
right.
of stories, and I would say, you want a real Southern story? How about this? You know, my town, 15 miles from the Canadian border, seceded from the Union, and my house was on the Underground Railroad. You should write that. And they go, and then I would do.
And you could never convince anyone to write that story.
No, you can't convince anybody to write a story. Everybody has a, you know, it's not hard to come up with a good story to write. It's the work of spending a couple of years of your life on it. That's the hard part.
So you, and before that, you had been a writer, but you'd written short stories and shorter pieces. Mm. You had never written a full length book. Yeah. Before.
Well, I hadn't even really taken on fiction at all. I'd written pieces for, you know, journalist pieces, yeah. Reviews and stuff like that, but I'd never really taken on a novel.
So you described it to the AJC as that you had to teach yourself how to write in order to do this book.
Yeah, well, you know, how to write a good sentence. You know, it's not easy to put on to, you know. To get the rhythm and the complexity of a good sentence and have different things going on, and you know if you pay attention to those things, it's not, you know, hopefully as a reader you never notice it, but as a writer you want to get it right.
So how do you teach yourself to write a novel? I mean, how does one do that? I mean, you've been reading, assuming, your whole life. So what else do you need to do?
Well, you know, one perfect example is the main character, Mary Willis, who's running this Underground Railroad station, right?
Yeah.
You know, and her true history is she had 17 siblings. So, you know, and I have a list of all those people when they were born and everything like that. So as I start to write, I feel like all of those siblings have to be in there, right? And I have a draft where she has 17 siblings and they get named at some point. It's terrible.
Yeah, you can't keep track of all
right?
of them.
You know,
yeah.
they serve no purpose. They just exist there. And, you know, in particular around writing historical fiction, it's about as much about what goes as what stays.
So tell me a little bit about Mary, your main character, and what was true and what isn't. Mary, she's I think lively is a fair word. She's quite young, just out of college, just a fierce 19th century feminist. So how much of that did you create?
Well, so Mary Willis, the true story of Mary Willis is she went away to college at Alfred University in 1857. She's about 18 years old at the time. Well, you know, women did not go to college in 1858. And she went to Alfred University, which was only the second school in the country to take women.
Yeah.
And it was Alfred is about 30 miles from Seneca Falls, New York, which is the epicenter of feminism. So these things come together. This and Rochester, New York, is where Frederick Douglass is writing. So all of these radical ideas are floating in the ethos in Western New York at the time. So it's reasonable to you know, to assume this woman is, I mean, she's imbued with this kind of feminism, and so that's I'm taking that as true, right? She goes to college. She comes home, 1858, and starts running an Underground Railroad station.
From the house
barn.
That you ended up living in.
Yeah. Well, it was a barn at the time.
Oh yeah.
Right. And it was converted into a house
so
later.
So that part's true.
Yeah. All of that's true.
Did you find any writings of hers that might have given you a clue to her personality or the way she spoke?
No, that was all
invented.
Yeah. I have some her signature on some legal papers and stuff, but I've never found any writing. I'm convinced she married at one point and moved across the street from this house, and then she moved home because the other house burned, And I'm convinced that her stuff was there because an educated woman, a college-educated woman, would have kept papers and diaries and stuff at the time.
But it may have gotten burned in the fire.
I feel like it was burned, but I also when I was a child, there was my parents came to made a trade to have all the stuff cleared out of the house, and there's a guy who came and took the stuff, and he had a diary in his hand, and he said, "Oh, look, I think that's a woman's hand." But I people ask me if that was hers. I don't know. I fantasize that it was, but I was 5 years old. I couldn't even read it. I have no idea what it was. Could have been the previous owners.
So this must be. I have to imagine this happens with everyone who writes historical fiction, where the reader is sitting there going, "Wait, which part of this is true and which isn't?" So, were there actually Confederate secret agents having raids across the border?
Can you believe that? I mean, nobody talks about this, but there was the Confederate Secret Service was run by a guy named Jacob Thompson, who there's a large monument to Jacob Thompson in downtown Oxford, Mississippi. He is and he became the basis for the Compson family Faulkner's books, one of Faulkner's books. He was implicated in 1865 in the John Wilkes Booth conspiracy, and had to flee the country. He lived over in England on $200,000 of mysteriously appeared hard cash for several years there before moving back to Oxford after supposedly clearing his name. But whether it was never really cleared. But there's this whole outlandish plot with Johnson's Island. Historically, this is true that he hired a guy named John Yates Beale, who was from right around Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. It was Virginia at the time. It hadn't split off to go to Johnson's Island, which is where there's an island full of Confederate soldiers that were prisoners, to take them to Buffalo, to break them free, arm them, take them to Buffalo, and set them loose to open up a northern front. This is all documented plot. It fell apart, obviously.
Clearly.
But these kind of, we'd never think about the Canadians' influence in the Civil War, but it's quite an active border at the time.
So why is there such fodder for fiction coming out of the Civil War? Why do we seem to never tire of those stories?
Well, I think, aren't we fighting the Civil War essentially in some ways right now? I mean, we're not in the street, generally not in the streets with guns, but...
Well, they were in Charlottesville.
Yeah, they were in Charlottesville. Those battles still rage one way or the other. It's, one of the, in my opinion, one of the tragedies of the Civil War, one of the wounds that has never been healed was, with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, there was never a proper movement to reconcile. Johnson, his
he was all about appeasement. Yeah.
Yeah. It was never never to get it right after that, and we've never healed from it.
So you had to create. Well, let's go back to the town. I want to make sure I say it right. It's Town Line, New York.
Yes.
And this was settled by Germans. This is a real town.
Yes.
And let's talk about how this town came to secede, which was part of the whole beginnings of this novel, right?
Yes. So so first off, Town Line, New York is a hamlet. It's a crossroads. It has no legal standing. It is the line between Alden, New York, and Lancaster, New York.
It's literally a town line.
Yeah, it is. There's no mayor. There's no city council. There's no legal standing. There's no. They have a volunteer fire department, and up until a few years, the volunteer fire department, their shoulder patch said "Last of the Rebels," 1865 to 1946, which is incorrect because, of course, they actually seceded in 1861. But there's a mythos going on here anyway, right? So, there's no contemporary documentation for the secession, but it's pretty clearly established that it happened. It was a vote of 100 to 23, and it's not quite clear what happened. Now,
or why?
Yeah. So,
I mean, you begin to, you imagine in, for your novel, a lot of those motivations and what was happening in the town at the time. But historically, do we have an answer to that?
Well, so Town Line, which is a pretty right-wing place today and has been for a long time.
I would imagine if they had those patches on there,
Imagine an alignment with the Confederacy, and there's a claim that they sent seven of their local boys south to fight in the war of Northern or in the Army of Northern Virginia. There's no documentation for that. I've never seen a name of anybody that did it. It's a very hypothetical thing. And that kind of thing, that story kind of floated in 1946 when the reunification happened. But the real historical basis is, I've talked to descendants of people who were there, and largely what the idea that I put out in the book is I think holds water.
The book also sort of forces us to contend with this idea of being an outsider. I mean, she's in the North, but she herself is very progressive. She went to a co-ed college, which at that time is very racy. And she's surrounded by this very conservative, as described even today, right-wing town. Is that something that you had experience with, or was that a sort of situation of being just kind of Cassandra screaming behind the walls of Troy, right? Was that a situation you had to fully imagine?
No, I'm half Asian, I'm half Chinese, and I grew up, I mean, there's not a minority, or there certainly wasn't besides me
in
Town Line when I was growing up. That kind of outsider status just felt absolutely natural to me. It wasn't hard to guess.
And the love story is imagined, is it not?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so you had to create, that wasn't her eventual husband, real eventual husband?
Well, her I don't know. How much should we spoil here?
So, don't spoil. Yeah, don't. Yeah. Don't tell that part. I don't want to lead you to any spoilers. But what I mean is, was there something in her eventual married relationship that you borrowed for the love story?
So I tried very hard to put Mary back down where I found her. I tried to pick her up historically. When the book starts, it's kind of where she is historically, and I tried to put her down right where she would have been at the time. But everything else is
in between.
Know,
it's
yeah,
all.
I take quite a few liberties in between. I'll grant you that. She ended up. Well, we won't spoil that.
No, but, don't spoil yeah. that.
But I will say, I think what you're asking about at root is perhaps that is Joe. The book opens with Joe, a fugitive slave who arrives at her farm, and he is a complete figment of my imagination.
That's author Darren Wong. His first novel is The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. It's out now, and he'll speak at the Savannah Book Festival in mid-February. For more information, visit our website, gpbnews.org. That's our show for today, but we would love to hear from you. And you know what we always take is book recommendations. So tell us what you're reading right now. Be honest. What's the book either on your Kindle or on your nightstand? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can post on Facebook or on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.